First thing I wanted to ask is, and you've been quoted as saying, jazz is all about imagination. And
jazz is all about improvisation, because when we create, when we improvise and create things that never had any existence before, it takes a great deal of imagination. It's like the building blocks of something you're trying to create, you know? And we're trying to make a statement intuitively, whether we know it or not. And our way of making a statement is through our instruments. What we feel at any given time, not only coming from our minds, but coming from our motivating hearts. And that's what gives us the voice.
Well, one of the things you have always said, it's about imagination. In jazz, we're all going to the same forest, but not the same trees.
That's it. That's it. Yeah, we play the same tunes. That's a symbolic, I'm saying, more metaphorically, I'm saying. We go to the same forest. That is, we have played from the same repertoire. But when we improvise, we're not playing the same solos over and over again. Symbolically, we're going to different trees, even though we're in the same forest, that is playing the same song. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's what makes it like an adventure. And we're on a safari, but not for live game, but for ideas and different concepts and things like that. So it's an adventure, something that we live for, we look forward to.
Benny, talk a little bit about jazz in the 60s and 50s when you were just really getting that firm foothold in terms of respect and your contributions to jazz and those great compositions that we all remember now in terms of the classics. I remember Clifford and some of those tunes that you composed back then. What's it like in that day and that maybe doesn't exist today?
It was exciting because we were still involved in things that had no prior existence. We were coming out of that era where we were being, where the newer ones, like me when I was much younger, of course, we were being put down by some of the older musicians because the music we were trying to embrace had no relevance to the music that had come before. You know, the drummer had come off of the hi-hat cymbal now, and he was playing what was the ride cymbal before for only crashes. Now he's playing the cymbal that were used for crashes while the guy's playing his solo and things like that. And the saxophone players had began to put the vibrato away. When Lester Young came on the scene and he wasn't using vibrato like Coleman Hawkins and he joined Count Basie, his wife said, "Let me play a record by Coleman Hawkins for you and show you what a saxophone's supposed to sound like with the vibrato." He wasn't using any vibrato. Things like that. We were beginning to do away with some of the older things and embrace some of the newer things. And those of us as neophytes, aspiring musicians growing up in Philadelphia, were being put down by the older and established musicians who had been playing the older way of playing. And they were saying things to us like, where's the bass drum? Because we weren't hearing the bass drum as boom, 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 boom anymore. We were feeling it like what you feel, boom, ba-boom, boom, da-boom, boom. It was different, you know. And they were saying, well, where's the melody? Well, heck, when you're improvising, you play the melody, and let's see what you got on your mind. You know, nobody comes to hear you play the melody over and over these days. After you play the melody, they want to know what you've got on your mind. And then some were saying, you guys play like you got a mouthful of hot rice. Well, that's where we felt like we wanted to go. And the music was taking on a different image. And so it was exciting. Because when John Coltrane and Jimmy Heath and I and Philly Joe, when we were getting started, we started with the older music. Yeah, we played. John and I were in a band. And the drummer was the leader, and he was playing on the hi-hat all through the whole song. And it was okay for us. And we endured it because we felt like by playing in a big band, John and I used to rehearse in my living room. Now we'd come out of my living room, and now we're playing in front of people. And to us, we were moving ahead. We were going forward to wherever we wanted to wind up. And where we were going to wind up, we had no idea, but we wanted to get there as soon as possible. So it was a step in moving forward. So we got put down a lot by the older fellas. But, of course, eventually the old fellas stopped playing. They died off. And now I'm one of the older fellas. and the music is still moving ahead.
Yeah.
And some of it's, most of it's good, but sometimes you hear things that are not so good. But then again, that's according to taste. It's a matter of how you perceive it, you know. But it's going ahead in spite of us. You know, time doesn't wait for anybody, and time doesn't back up for mistakes. It doesn't back up for guilty consciences. No, it moves ahead, and either we're going to be in tune with it, either it's going to be our confederate, or it's not. And if it's not, symbolically, it's like a person has fallen overboard. And we tread water as long as we can as a ship sails over the horizon. You know, and that's the way it is. But for me, I choose to be on the cutting edge. I want to move ahead with the time. I don't want to keep serving that same old warmed over dish all the time when other things are available. You see what I mean?
Well, I understand. And, you know, I think it's, you do a fantastic job of putting the music in a context. And to hear you talk about present day and moving the music ahead, that's one thing. That's a beautiful thing. But also when you talk about where the music came from and how, you know, how the music came about, because what you were experiencing at that time, and you mentioned Philadelphia, which is your hometown. What was so special about that area and that so many musicians just out of one community, basically, the Heath Brothers and everybody. What was so special then that, and Detroit is kind of the same way in a lot of regards.
You're right.
Wow.
Well, let me say two things. I'm talking about moving ahead, but in moving ahead, it doesn't necessarily mean that you put down the things from an older era, but what we do is we make room on the same shelf, so to speak. You know, you move other things aside, and you enlarge what you're doing, which you know, I mean, I'm an older man now, and I come from the era I'm talking about, but still I have vestiges from the past, because that's a part of my structure, the things that I built on when I was learning how to play. So we don't throw the old things away, we just add to what was going on. So we have new things that come up, of course, but then we have extrapolations too, new ways of doing the older things, which in itself is almost like a creation. And there again, the imagination is essential, sine qua non, as they say, that Latin expression. Essential that you have imagination when you're creating things that had no prior existence, architecture, anything. Imagination is something. Otherwise, we'd be driving around in 1929 Fords all the time. Imagination is very important when you're creating or doing things that had no prior existence.
Benny, your legacy is well established as one of the greatest composers in jazz, and quite a book on some of the great quote-unquote jazz standards. And we do a program here called Stories of Standards, and basically we kind of break it out in terms of the origins of the song, either from the Great American Songbook or a tune that a jazz musician composed and wrote, and it was a jazz standard basically almost from the beginning, because other musicians embraced it, and there's, you know, many different versions of tunes like Killer Joe and Stablemates and Whispered Knot. Of course, I remember Clifford. What, looking back on it now, what makes, I mean, is there any way to predict when you're writing or doing something that this song has some those same qualities that that could be embraced, that may make this a new and future standard for musicians?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
You have no way of knowing when you do those things. You're just doing them. You have no way at all. When I did Killer Joe, and I asked my wife, she was the only one there, from 9 in the morning till 9 at night, all she heard was these two chords. And when I finally got it together that night and asked her, what does she think about it? She said, it'll never make it. She was so annoyed hearing these two chords all day long. She was going crazy. She said, it's too darn monotonous. And I tell my audiences, after 3 or 4 fur coats, she changed her mind. Did we never know? I didn't know about I Remember Clifford. I did that because of what I felt. I had no idea. I mean, today there are over 500 recordings on that song.
Yeah.
I had no way of knowing that. Otherwise, Carlos, I'd wake up one morning and say, huh, I think I'll write a hit today. There is no such thing.
Right.
What determines whether or not it's going to be a hit is the way it's accepted and the way people demand, I'll put that word in quotes, when they want to hear it. Do they buy the CD? Do they come to hear you play it? Do they request it? Things like that. That's what decides whether or not it's going to be a success. Now, we talk about successes. Let's look at the failures. Nobody ever talks about all the dogs that Benny Golson wrote that nobody has ever heard and don't want to hear. I Found My True Love in Mexico. I'm Finger Popping and Hip Shaking. I mean, those things I keep to keep in my piano bench to keep my head from getting too big. You don't want to even hear about some of those things. Horrible.
Well,
I'm not a genius.
No, but on the other hand, you are a professional songwriter. You've composed music, what's the term I'm looking for? When someone hires you to write music for a particular project.
Oh, that's called writing on demand, yeah.
Yes, yeah, and you've done a lot of that in your career, not just for television shows, for pop artists, and for everyone else. So when there is a formula there, but not for jazz.
Yeah, when you're writing on demand, it's like going to a tailor and say, I want you to make me a suit. And you tell him, I want the lapels to be like this, and I want the pants to be without cuffs, and I want the pants not to be 30 inches in the thigh, but maybe make them about 26. You have certain rules and standards that you adhere to because you're writing for somebody else what they want. And so you have to adhere to that when you're writing on demand. If you're writing, when I was writing particular shows, MASH and Room 222 and some of those things, I knew what the formula was and what they wanted, and so you're right within that. And you're not prostituting yourself. That's the nature of what you do. You are a composer, you are an orchestrator or an arranger, and you do what the show or the particular thing needs. You don't go in and say, well, the heck with what they want, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. That's like going to tell the tailor what you want to make, and when you go to get the suit, it's made some other kind of way. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And if when you approach it, it goes against what you feel you want to write, then you don't accept the assignment. I can't make that suit for you.
Last question, Benny. John Coltrane, you were close with John. You guys grew up together.
More than anybody else.
Yeah. Was he the... And you watched and you were there. Any insight into his musical progression in terms of what he played in the 50s, what inspired him, and how things evolved up into his death?
John was insatiable. When I met John, he was an alto saxophonist and had the beautiful sound. People talk about cannonball sound. You should have heard John Coltrane as an alto saxophonist. Absolutely gorgeous. And when I met him, he was playing. You remember Johnny Hodges with Duke Ellington?
Of course.
That's who he sounded like. He sounded exactly like Johnny Hodges. Exactly like Johnny Hodges. And we take it from there. It evolved. We were hearing the same things. We heard Charlie Parker at the same time. Things began to change. We heard Dizzy Gillespie. We used to sit in my living room and buy the old, I don't know if you remember the 38 records, 37 or whatever it was, and three-quarter records.
33 and three-quarters.
33 and three-quarters. It's been so long I've forgotten.
No, I'm sorry,
right?
33
we
and a third.
37 cents for each disc that we bought. And when we got that record, it was black and shiny, and when we finished, it was dull and gray, because the tone arm, we used to have a needle that you put in it and get about 10 plays, it had a little screw on it. We'd put that tone arm back and forth, back and forth. What did he play in the... Wait a minute, put it back. What did he play here? Well, let's see, play that again. When we finished with that, that was our school. That's all we had. There were no school and classes and diplomas that you could get for playing jazz. That was it. And going to the jam sessions, that was our education. And occasionally, if we got a chance to hear them perform, like John and I did, the first time we heard Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, we went crazy. We heard them live. Crazy. We almost fell out over the balcony when they started to play. I mean, this was an exciting time. And that excitement never left us. And we wanted to grow along with the music, because music the approach to the music was changing then, and the music itself was growing. So the songs we used to play in the beginning, the chord structures were not original. So the themes or melodies were based on How High the Moon, which was ornithology, or Whispering, Groovin' High, which was Whispering, and things like that. And then later, new structures that had no beginning, like these other standards, began to take shape. What does the other one do? This Tad Dameron wrote Hot House, which is, what is this thing called, Love. And then we had different things. Confirmation by Charlie Parker, which was based on no standard. And then all those, nowadays, that's all we have. Very few tunes are based on standards anymore. And the music evolved like that. It was an exciting time, and we happened to be privileged of growing with it. But what we had to do, we had to change horses in the middle of the stream, because John was playing alto like Johnny Hodges, and I was trying to play tenor like Ornette Cobb, who played Flying Home with Lionel Hampton. That's what we were engrossed in. Then Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie came along and upset the apple cart, and we had to change streams as amateurs in the middle of the stream. We hadn't gotten hold, we hadn't gotten a grip on the old established stuff, and now we're trying to change streams, and we're like in another land and no man's world there. You know what I'm saying? So it was difficult, and then we were getting put down too by the older fellows. So it was kind of a difficult time, but we wanted to do it so much, and our thins were so thick that we weren't disturbed by the insults and things like that. So we kept moving ahead. And the music wound up being where it is today, and it hasn't stopped moving forward, thank goodness. That's why we keep those who are wise, we keep our ears open. We don't reject anything without hearing and find out what it's all about.
That's the old saying, two ears and one mouth for a reason.
That's right. And it's exciting. It is exciting. And as musicians, intuitively what we do, Carlos, every morning when we wake up, we intuitively think, what can I do better today than I did yesterday? We try to best ourselves. We want to move ahead. Becoming too satisfied ourselves with ourselves is a caveat that we want to avoid. When you become too satisfied with yourself, you level off, and creativity and moving ahead no longer is of any concern to you. Yeah, I'm an older man now. I want to keep moving ahead as long as I'm able to put that horn in my mouth. I don't want to stay in the same spot. And that's my engine. That's what keeps me moving forward.
Well, Benny, we're looking forward to the fact that you are moving on your way to Denver here in a few days, and we'll get a chance once again to experience your music, experience the music from the musicians which you choose to bring with you, and it'll be quite an evening. We're looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward again, too. I mean, one of the first things that had nothing to do with music. One of the first things that I couldn't understand when I first came to Denver, I was at the stoplight with the stoplight to change. And usually, in the other cities I'd been in, when the stoplight changes, you walk in one direction. The stoplight changed, and the people were going everywhere across the street. I said, what? What is this? Does that still happen? I'm not sure.
They changed it, Benny, because someone must have heard you.
I couldn't get over that when I came to Denver. That was back in 1951.
Yeah, that was called the X approach, where people can
That's
cross.
Right. I said, these people are crazy.
Benny.
Yeah, but I remember Denver. I have fond memories about Denver, and I'm looking forward to coming back.
Yeah, memories of Five Points, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Golson. We appreciate it, and we will see you here at Mount Vernon Country Club here in Colorado soon.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.